Thank you. So I'm on. Right. So yeah, my name's Ian. I'm an accessibility specialist, and I've been working in the field of game accessibility for just over 10 years now. But I wasn't born caring about accessibility. Before that point, before I started working in the field, there were a number of misconceptions I had about accessibility. And through my time working in the field, speaking to the developers, there's the same set of misconceptions that I keep coming back to and keep hearing again and again. And it's summed up by this. So there's a few quotes in this presentation. I'm going to read them all out. So accessibility is difficult and expensive and means diluting my vision. Making the game less enjoyable for everyone just to benefit a tiny niche group. So there's some combination of these. Sometimes it's one single point, sometimes it's lots of them. I come across them over and over again. So the purpose of this talk is to disprove this statement. And for two reasons. Firstly, if there's people in the room who have doubts, concerns about some of these kind of things, hopefully you'll be able to leave a bit reassured. Also, the other purpose is because something I come across a lot is particularly in bigger companies, bigger studios, publishers, is coming across individual developers who really, really want to do some good stuff, but have a hard time getting it past their colleagues, past their managers, being able to justify getting on the backlog up against all these other features. So hopefully, if you're working in a company where in that kind of situation, we're having a hard time having these kind of conversations, hopefully this talk will give you a bit of material that you can use and make some of those discussions a little bit easier. So this is a slightly longer slot, so I'm going to tackle this from a few different angles. And I'm going to cover these three things, why, what, and how. So why is going to be the bulk, the reasons why accessibility is worth considering. I'm also going to talk in a little bit of detail about just a few key things to consider, and then finishing up by touching on a few of the tools and techniques that are available to you as well. So why? I'm going to start the why with a story. And this is a story about the kind of thing that actually first got me interested in accessibility myself. And what you're looking at here is something that's called an accessibility switch. So this button on the table in front of this girl. And this is an input device that's used by people who aren't able to use a traditional controller, keyboard, mouse, that kind of thing. It refers to quite a wide range of different input devices, but they all work in the same way, which is a simple on-off signal. So that could be a button like that. It could be a button on the wheelchair headrest. It could be blowing into a tube, blinking an eye, like Stephen Hawking kind of stuff. And I was working on a project for CBeebies at the time, which is the BBC's preschool network. And this was for games that had to be accessible to this kind of technology. And it got to the stage of the project, one of the many stages in the project, when we were going out and doing user research, user testing, and we're going into kids' homes to see the kind of setups they used in day-to-day. And we were doing the recruitment for this, finding kids to go and visit, and we made a bit of a rookie error. So when writing the recruitment profile, we said we were looking for children who had this kind of technology. What we should have said was children who used this kind of technology, because actually we went into someone's home and the child had a quite similar setup to this. It was a button, but it was kind of like a big flat one, but they didn't use it. They didn't use it because they couldn't use it. Because this kid in particular had really profound motor impairment. So even just that simple action of operating just that single on-off button was really, really difficult, really, really painful. And this child also had really severe learning difficulties. They're completely nonverbal, had very limited understanding of what's going on around them. So the parents couldn't actually explain to the child why they should have to go through this ordeal of operating this button. And the reason why they wanted them to operate that button was because of technology like this. So this is a communications device. Well, basically, you can see here you have a grid of words and a highlight appears around one of these words. Every couple of seconds, the highlight advances on. Once it's over the word you want, you make whatever tiny input you can, it selects it. You can then build up a sentence and have it spoken out via synthesized speech. So it's very similar, actually, to the way that Stephen Hawking communicates. So if their child could operate this technology, they would actually be able to have a meaningful conversation with their child for the first time. But they couldn't do it. They couldn't explain to them why they have to go this ordeal, like I said. So obviously, we were going to get nowhere with our playtesting if they couldn't operate this accessibility switch. But the game was associated with a very popular kids' television show in the UK. So the father said, you know, as you're here, we already know that that our child likes this TV show. So you may as well just put the game on the screen and they'll get something from the experience, even though they can't play. It's called Something Special. Do you know Something Special, Mr. Tumble? It's a really nice TV show. It's basically aimed at language development in nonverbal autistic preschoolers. But it's all-inclusive design for all audiences, wildly popular with all children. So it's shown in all TVs all over, all schools all over the land. And something else it's done a really nice job of is also normalizing disability. So for the 10 years or so it's been running, there's these kids are growing up seeing disability in the context of day-to-day life on the TV, which is another really nice thing. But it's a nice show. It's worth checking out. I'll just get out of the way for a second. So basically what happened was the father put their child in their lap and just played the game for them. So he took hold of their child's hand and just was pressing the button for them. And then as the game progressed, he said, look at that. And the child was just starting to stretch their fingers out in an attempt to press the button. And that child had never done anything like that before. And as a result, the lives of that child, the lives of that family were going to be fundamentally different. Not just now through that interaction, but through all the other types of technology that child would be able to operate as their life progressed and lead a much more meaningful and independent life. And the reason why this has succeeded when everything else had failed was because it was a game. So that engagement that we're all so familiar with, you know, there was no longer any need to try to explain to this child why they should have to do it. This child just really wanted to play with Mr. Tumble on the screen. That's all it took. So it's no understatement at all, no exaggeration at all, even to say that games can really profoundly transform people's lives. And it doesn't need to be, you know, through like this kind of niche stuff either. That applies to any game. Because what games actually are is access to recreation, to culture, to socializing. Now, these are things that so many people just take for granted. But if for any reason your means of accessing those things in day-to-day life is restricted, all of a sudden games, any games, can become a really, really powerful contributor to people's quality of life. So that's the first reason. The second reason is something a little bit more mercenary. It's just cold, hard cash. So the business case, because people with disabilities are a market, and not just a market, but a sizable market. If I had a penny for every time someone said to me, people with disabilities account for less than 1% of the population, actually the most recent census data for the USA is 22% of adults. Now, not everyone within that 22% is going to experience barriers relating to playing games, but that's more than balanced out by the other conditions that aren't included in that 22%. Things like colorblindness, 8% of males, difficulty reading, 14%. Of American adults. So these kind of, whichever way you look at the figures, it's big numbers, and that relates to a big market, which equates to money to be made and money to be lost. And the reason Candy Crush is up on the screen is this is a nice example of that. Now what you're looking at the moment is really a textbook example of how you should design for colorblindness. So you can see, even though things are differentiated by color, they're also differentiated by shape as well. So regardless of what kind of color perception you have, you'll still be able to play this game. Initially, So you progress on a bit further, and a new mechanic is introduced, the bombs. The bombs now are differentiated by colour alone. So I'd like you just to keep your eye on these three bombs at the bottom, the green, the orange, and the red. And I'll show you what this looks like with one of the most common forms of colorblindness. So that's it. Gone. You can't play anymore. So for a game like Candy Crush in particular, which is a free-to-play game that has a business model that's based on retention, this is devastating. You're relying on that core small group of players who keep playing again and again and again, spending more money than that purchases. And if they come up against the barrier like that, that's it. That revenue stream is gone. And to put that in context, you know, when this kind of stuff was going on, Candy Crush at the time was making hundreds of millions of dollars per quarter. Now, if you think about the 8% of males who are colorblind, that equates to just a staggering amount of money lost in this game through a really, really trivial design decision. But if that design decision had been made differently, all of a sudden you would make all that money instead of losing all that money. Another important side to the business case is that it's not just about people with permanent impairments. The design decisions that you make for someone who has a permanent impairment, such as only having one arm, also benefits people with temporary impairments, such as a broken arm. Also benefits people with situational impairments, such as holding a baby or holding a beer. Common use case, right? So that again amplifies the numbers of people that this benefits. And even beyond that too, into people who don't have any kind of impairment at all. So what you're looking at here is the accessibility menu in Uncharted 4. Now, Uncharted 4 has got a bunch of accessibility settings aimed primarily at fine motor ability. Some of these features are aimed at allowing you to play the game one-handed using a single stick. So do some nice stuff with aim assist and automatic camera movement, so you can play a game just using a single hand. Now, if you're thinking about that purely from a impairment perspective, you'd be looking at people who only have one hand, which accounts for slightly under 1% of the population, which is often the argument you come up against. Like, how can I justify doing this development for less than 1% of the population when I've got this feature over here, which is going to be used by all our players? Actually, these features weren't used by just under 1% of the population of their gamer population. They're actually used by 30% of their players. And that's a really, really common thing with accessibility, because what you're actually doing is avoiding unnecessary barriers to people's enjoyment. And often what is a really big show-stopping barrier for one person is still going to be a bit of annoyance for other players as well. So through addressing that barrier, you're actually making the game better for wide numbers of players. Another example of that, a game that you've already heard mentioned today, Killer Instinct. So the kind of features that Ben was talking about earlier, the work that's already been done in Killer Instinct, things like having a separate volume slider just for those UI sounds, for the work done in the audio design to ensure that every single sound is unique and distinct. Now, this is stuff that was worked on specifically for blind gamers, but they are still features that are useful for gamers across the board. They just make the game better in general. And one last example in this. Is anyone familiar with this game? No, not State of the K, no. Good guess, though. Yes, it is. Yep, Into the Dead. Yes, I'm very glad you said that. So the tilt control. This is an endless runner. You're based on mobile. You're running into the screen through a field of zombies and have to dodge in between them as they try and eat you. And throughout most of development, the controls for it were tilt. So you tilt your phone and your tablet from side to side to dodge in between the zombies. You know, the designers have considered all kinds of different options for the control schemes, but, you know, they're designers. They understand what fun is. They knew that tilt was the most fun, and they went with that. But right towards the end of development, their user researcher, a guy called Hadley Bellum, he actually persuaded the rest of the team to implement some options on the basis of accessibility. So, you know, he explained to them, you know, there's going to be some people who can't physically pick up and tilt a tablet. And the rest of the team were like, yep, okay, fair enough. Good point. So they implemented some alternatives. So you've got a left and the right button on either side. You've got a virtual thumbstick on the left or a virtual thumbstick on the right. But of course, as I said, they already knew that tilt was the fun option. So this was basically an altruistic gesture for, you know, the very small percentage of gamers who couldn't physically use tilt would use these other options. Everyone else would use this one. And then they tracked the usage data. And the usage data came out as 25%, 25%, 25%, 25%. So this altruistic gesture that they had made actually had made the game a better experience for the 75% of their players who preferred not to use tilt. So moving on, another really important reason to consider accessibility that is also part of the business case is the PR value. And the PR value can work both ways. So this example is from For Honor. It was a story about the lack of remapping in the game and players using their own third-party tools to try and do the remapping and being banned as a result. This is not the kind of publicity that you really want to have accompanying the launch of your game. Now, if you look at another recent example, Overwatch. So Blizzard thanked by fan with cerebral palsy for endless control customization in Overwatch. This was a game that provided remapping. And as a result, because of you, I made my first snipe in the video game today. This is the type of publicity you want to go along with the launch of your game. And in terms of the business case, if you think about the kind of marketing spend that would have to go into generating this kind of publicity, it would be quite substantial. So I've got two more news articles here, but this is actually moving on to quite a different point. So what we've got at the top here is an article about Borderlands 2 getting a colorblind mode. So this was from 2014. There was three games, Borderlands 2, Black Ops 2, and SimCity, that implemented colorblind modes. And this wasn't something that was really commonly considered. So this was big, big news across all the games press. Fast forward to 2016, this is a story about The Witness. So by 2016, just 2 years later, the industry had changed. Colorblindness was becoming a really common consideration, enough that players' expectations had also changed, and players were starting to get really quite annoyed if a game didn't consider colorblindness. So this article is actually an apology piece by a journalist apologizing for failing to mention that The Witness wasn't colorblind friendly. So that was a huge, huge turnaround just in the space of 2 years. And that's particularly relevant if you're working on a AAA title, where 2 years might be within the development cycle of a single game. So it's another really important reason to consider accessibility, because if you are setting out to start developing a game today, by the time that game launches, there will be features that aren't even considered today that will be expected by that point. So it's really, really beneficial to stay ahead of that curve, in which case you can actually be the people who are defining those expectations rather than becoming a victim of them. Next reason. So this is a picture of a piece of legislation being signed in 2010 by Obama, which is called CVAA, which is the 21st Century Communications and Video Accessibility Act. Now, what this legislation did was enshrined as a legally protected, but not particularly pronounceable, right, of people with disabilities to be able to access communications technology and broadcast video. And the communications technology aspect of it specifically explicitly applies to games. Now, the way it applies is the legislation basically divided the industry into three buckets. There was games consoles, self-explanatory, networks, which is stuff like Xbox Live and Steam, and also software, which is the games themselves. Now, to start with, the entire industry was given a waiver from having to comply with this legislation to give a bit of time for R&D and investigation, figure out the best ways they could actually implement this kind of stuff. The waivers for consoles and networks have since passed. They're now covered by this legislation. The waiver for games is currently due to expire in January. So there may or may not be another extension. We won't find out until January. But either way, you really need to be thinking about this stuff now. It only covers a relatively small part of game development. It's just about communication. So the kind of stuff that Michael was talking about being able to communicate if you're deaf, if you're blind and there's text chat, that kind of thing. It's just about communication. But you really need to be thinking about this stuff now, because if there isn't a waiver extension in January, every game published after January needs to be compliant with this. And this isn't the end either. This is a story from earlier this year. The UK government is taking quite an interest in disability across all kinds of industries. And they did a piece of research into the issues and concerns facing young people with disabilities. And the number one top concern they had of anything in their lives was lack of representation in video games. And as Josh was pointing out earlier, that is dependent on accessibility in video games. So there's not much point in having a character that represents you in a game that you can't play. So this didn't actually result in legislation. It resulted in one of the senior people in the UK games industry being allocated the sector disability champion for the games industry. So they have an explicit responsibility now to try and improve this. But it's just an example that in the future, I would assume that CVA isn't the last time that legislators are going to cast their eyes towards the industry. And that does carry with it a level of risk, a level of risk that you're going to have people outside the games industry deciding regulations that apply to the games industry, not necessarily with a good understanding of the constraints of how games are developed, all that kind of stuff. But there is a nice example from, again, from the UK, legislation in the UK, the Equalities Act, which is the UK's catch-all anti-discrimination legislation, has an exemption for the television industry. Television industry has no legal accessibility requirements. And the reason for that is because they have a regulatory body, which is Ofcom, which is kind of like the FCC. They spoke to the lawmakers and said, we've already got this covered. We already self-regulate. We already have our own internal quotas for exactly how many minutes of television have to be subtitled, that kind of stuff. We don't need a second set of regulations because we already do a good job of it ourselves. And that's what I would dearly, dearly love to see from the games industry. The next time lawmakers turn their eyes towards the industry, for us to be able to say, you know, we've got this. We don't need extra regulations. We already do a good job. So all that legal talk is a bit heavy, I know. So for the last thing in the wire, I'm going to do something a bit more enjoyable. I'm going to do some audience participation because I know everybody loves that. So it's not going to be painful, I promise. I'm just going to ask you for a show of hands. So I'm going to go out on a limb here and assume everybody in the room currently games. So I would like to see a show of hands. I'd like you to raise your hand if you are planning on giving up gaming by the time you reach the age of 65. No, no takers. I told you it was going to be painless. Bryce, had to be one. So the reason I was asking that is because 65 is the age at which you cross the 50% mark. If you're over 65, you actually have a 50% chance of having some kind of impairment. So that's the last reason why accessibility is worth considering. And it is a purely selfish one. That we need to be putting into place good practices and principles now so that all of us are able to continue to game as we get older. And I actually saw an interesting discussion about this online on this exact point. And someone on some forum somewhere was saying, you know, I don't think this is really a good argument, because I think by the time I'm over 65, I'm not going to be interested. I'm just going to want to be sat there in my couch or my rocking chair watching my grandkids playing games. And I saw a really nice response back to them, which said, actually, I prefer to be playing the games with my grandkids. So next, what? So all this is all well and good, the reasons why you should consider it. What should you actually do? It can be quite intimidating. Often when people start thinking about accessibility, this is the kind of picture that people have in their heads, because it's hard enough to think about designing something that you like, let alone trying to cater for core and casual. How do you even begin to start thinking about something like this? And it often ends up with people becoming paralyzed and actually deciding to do nothing. And that isn't just in gaming, that's across other industries as well. I see this a lot, people thinking, like, because I can't do anything, I'm just not going to touch the topic. And that's the worst thing that can happen. The important thing is just to start. Even if you just do one tiny thing, you know, it doesn't matter if you can't do everything. Every tiny step you take simply means that more people are going to have a better experience with your game. And actually, this kind of thing as well, this actually isn't so important, because this is a list of medical conditions. And when you design for accessibility, you don't design for medical conditions, you design for the barriers that people encounter, the things those conditions interact with. And often those barriers are shared. So if you take, for example, Parkinson's, dyspraxia, those are two medical conditions that have absolutely nothing in common with each other medically. But they both come up against the same barrier of small, fiddly interface elements. So if you can remove that barrier, you've actually made the game a better experience for both of those completely different groups. And also, if you're removing the barrier of small interface elements, you're also addressing a whole swathe of visual conditions as well. So once you start thinking about this, think about accessibility in terms of barriers, it only really comes down to four broad groups that have a lot of shared barriers in between them. So this is barriers relating to people's ability to see, people's ability to hear, people's ability to take in and process information, and people's ability to manipulate a controller. There's also a fifth one as well, speech. That isn't relevant to most games. Where that really comes in is, and similar to hearing loss actually, is in-game communication. So even if you spend even just the smallest amount of time at the outset of a project, and this is really key, at the outset of a project, a little bit of time thinking about your mechanic, thinking about what barriers would be presented to these five groups, you'll be able to make a big, big difference. And you will come across barriers that can't be removed. As Josh was saying earlier, that's something that separates accessibility in game development from other industries. Because exactly as Josh was saying earlier, if you remove all the barriers from a game, you remove all the challenge, and what you're basically left with is an interactive narrative or a toy. It's no longer a game. There will be some barriers that are an essential part of what makes that game enjoyable. And that's totally fine. It's not about removing all the barriers. It's about removing the unnecessary barriers, making sure that nobody is unnecessarily excluded. And the way you do that, the vast majority of barriers that people encounter can actually be addressed pretty simply through one of two techniques. The first one is communicating information in more than one way. So like in Candy Crush, using shape as well as color, like subtitles using text as well as audio. Then the second way, allowing some flexibility, providing some options. So things like a choice of control schemes, choice of difficulty levels, choice of game speed. So I'm going to give you just a few examples of the kind of things that you can consider. I'm going to show you four examples, and these four examples are the four most commonly complained about accessibility issues. So I have to give a little bit of a caveat that most commonly complained about doesn't mean most common. So for example, the reading age that I was talking about earlier, that isn't really discussed a lot because there's so much of a stigma around it. People who've got difficulty reading aren't as comfortable talking about it as, for example, someone who's got difficulty hearing. But still, it is a starting point. These four things are really, really common accessibility issues. Even if you only address one of these issues, you still make a really significant difference to your game. And the first one comes under vision, and it's color blindness. So a quote here from Karen Stevens estimating that over 500,000 Madden players are colorblind. There's a range of techniques that you can use for color blindness. I mean, you saw earlier from the simulation on Candy Crush, the majority of forms of color blindness basically mean you see in a reduced color palette. There is actually a rarer form where you don't see in any color at all. There's also some interesting edge cases. For example, if you have color blindness that you've acquired through brain or optic nerve injury, they can have some quite unique personal individual effects. But for all of those different things, if you just take the approach from here upwards in Candy Crush of not relying on color alone to communicate information, that means you can address all those different edge cases. It doesn't matter how you perceive color. So this is one way you can do that, through using shape as well as color. Another example, this is from a color-based puzzle platformer called Q, where they are using symbol as well as color. And this another good application for this is on like mini maps and that kind of stuff. Using pattern as well as color. So this is on the racing line. So you can see they're using a broken line to indicate when to accelerate and a solid line to indicate when you need to brake. So that should always be your first port of call. Try to avoid relying on color to communicate information. I mean, by all means, use color, but back it up with something else as well. Once you've done that, you also need to do a bit of testing as well, because it doesn't just affect your ability to tell colors apart. Basically, what you're doing is you're picking up and perceiving even less light of a certain frequency, so that color actually appears darker. So if you are red deficient, if you pick up less red light, you will find it difficult to distinguish red from dark brown and black. So it's worth running your designs through a color blindness simulator to check to see if you have those kind of color contrast issues going on. And this actually differs a little bit from other types of accessibility, because amongst colorblind gamers, colorblind people in general, there is a relatively low level of awareness of what the different types of colorblindness are, what the different severities of colorblindness are, and what type and what severity you personally have. So it can be really, really difficult to accurately test using real people. So when testing colorblindness, you should use a simulator as your first port of call. You should then also test with people who are colorblind, but rather than using it as a form of validation, as a way to tell you that your game is okay, instead use it the other way around. Use it as a way to pick up on issues that you might have missed out on. So if that's the dream scenario, avoid color reliance, use a simulator and do some testing. That doesn't always work. There are situations where using something in addition to color doesn't always work. For example, distinguishing team colors in a deathmatch. And this is for Honor. What they've done here is actually they've used orange and blue for their team colors. And that orange and blue combination actually works for all three of the most common types of color blindness. It doesn't work for the edge cases, you know. So if you're those one of those 1 in 10,000 who only sees in black and white, this is no good. But it does at least cover the basics. And the reason I'm using Frona as an example is actually there's something else interesting going on here, which is how they're approaching these icons. And this is actually something that's relating to contrast in general, but it's also useful for color blindness. So you can see what they've done is they've put a double stroke around the icons. So each icon has a black outline surrounded by a white outline. Through doing that, they've ensured that there is always separation from the background. So over here, this is against light backgrounds. There is that black outline separating it from the icon. And over here, against the dark background, you have the white outline separating it from the icon. So regardless of what color you're perceiving this icon to be, it's always going to stand out against the background because you always have that black outline or that white outline to separate it. Another approach. This is the approach that colorblind gamers ask for all the time. They very, very rarely get it, but this is what colorblind gamers want, to be able to customize their colors, just to be able to choose which team color is which. That then allows you to address, well, it doesn't allow you to, it allows people from whatever edge case they've got to address it themselves, choose the options that best suit their own personal needs. So this applies to things like team colors and minimap markers, also just things like being able to customize the crosshair as well. And again, if you've got a red crosshair and you have difficulty seeing that against like the dark, muddy brown, grey colours that make up the backgrounds of most first-person shooters, then being able to customise that is really helpful. So this is a free choice of colours. What you see more commonly is presets. So people have basically taken that approach, but they've defined a few sets of colour palettes for the common types of colour blindness. This has some disadvantages. It means that you can't address the edge cases, but it has the advantage of avoiding the burden of having to customize everything. So the dream would be to combine the two. So if you have these, common presets of color palettes, which you know are going to work for decent buckets of people, you then have a custom option underneath in a similar kind of way that you would do for controls. So controls, you might have standard controls, left, pull, nomad, and custom, which allows you to remap the buttons. Do the same thing with your colors. So number two, I'm going to read this quote out again. With how small the text is in games like Grand Theft Auto 5, everything turns out blurred and unclear. I accidentally spent $4,500 on a car because of that. And this is a really, really common issue. And this is something that really wasn't an issue. A few years ago, showing my age, it was a lot longer than that. But before HD, this like tiny text really wasn't an issue because you simply didn't have the option of making small text. You didn't have the pixels to be able to. Now you do have the pixels to be able to make small text, but just because you can doesn't mean that you should. So now we end up with situations like this. And this. These are all console games, so designed to be played on the TV on the other side of your room. And this. So you see where it says tram console? I'll help you out here. That is your primary objective. That's the most important piece of information in the game. So this is a really, really widespread issue. And as was already pointed out, it's an easy issue to run up against because when you are designing a UI in a game, you are not sat on a couch designing on a screen that's 6 feet away from you. You're designing it on a 28-inch screen that's, you know, a foot away from your face. So it's a common issue to come up against. What would be really helpful is to have some kind of a standard to work to, you know, something that avoids that issue of your setup not matching the gameplay environment, and just have a figure to work to, right? Which exists, and it's this. So 28 pixels for standard static UI. For text that is only on the screen for a short amount of time, like subtitles, like notifications, up to 46. And where this comes from, this is actually from PlayStation. And it was basically calculated by reverse engineering the Snellen chart, which is the when you go to the opticians and you see the scale of letters going down, that basically tells you what you should be able to see at certain distances. And this actually perfectly matches up with other guidelines from elsewhere. So Amazon's 10-foot TV guidelines also recommend that exact same figure. The subtitles one is slightly different. That comes from the TV industry. And this is something I'm going to come back to in a little bit about other industries, because this problem has already been solved through many decades of research. And working in the games industry, if you just turn your head slightly to the side, you can see that all these problems have already been solved, and just steal them and apply them to games. So this is what it looks like on the screen. This is what you should be aiming for. But it's worth pointing out, though, as well, that this is based on someone who has 20/20 vision. So this really is a minimum. If you can go above these sizes, it's always worth doing. So hearing that brings me on neatly onto talking about subtitles. So I might already cover this a bit, but subtitles are used for so many reasons in games. They're used, obviously, because of physical hearing loss, essential. Also used because you're playing in a noisy environment. Used because English isn't your first language, so you find it difficult to understand the accents of robots and aliens. Used because the audio mixes in games are unpredictable. You don't know when there's going to be an explosion going off right in the middle of an important bit of exposition or instruction. You might use subtitles because you're playing on public transport, and hopefully you're not the kind of person who plays on public transport with the volume turned up without headphones. So they're used for all these kind of different reasons, and so it's not really surprising to see data like this. So this is citing 79% of people play with subtitles turned on. I have to give a bit of disclaimer in that this is thoroughly unscientific. This is just a straw poll of, you know, 500 people on the website. But still, it starts to paint a picture. So given all these different reasons for playing with subtitles turned on, given how many people play with them, given the impact it can have on someone's experience of a game, obviously it justifies some investment in doing a good job on them. But nobody does. I mean nobody. I do include all of your games in this. Which is a bold statement to make, but it's not me that's making the statement. This is directly from the gamers. So this is just coming from, you know, one page of one thread on the EarGAF. Gamers really, really are not happy about this. So I'm not going to read out all of these, but I'll just give one highlight which I think sums it up. Most gaming subtitles are ass. But you can see the kind of things that people are complaining about. There's a couple of really common themes. Again, these are touched on earlier, but size and contrast. These are the kind of things that people are coming up against. So for the benefit of people who can't see the image, this is some white text on the white background. And from this you can see, you know, this isn't rocket science. These are easy, easy problems to fix. And again, you can look across at other industries who've already cracked all this kind of stuff. If you look at the TV industry, companies like the BBC have really good, well-researched guidelines into this kind of stuff. You can just look sideways, take the guidelines, apply them directly to games. And this is what you should be aiming for. So this is from a game called Bertram Fiddle. You can see this is using a nice, easy-to-read, mixed-case typeface in decent size and very clearly separated from the background. I think it might be a bit difficult to tell on the screen, but there's basically a black gradient behind it and also a black stroke around the text as well. This is what you should be aiming for as a minimum. And I say as a minimum because actually there are different use cases for subtitles. So some people who have profound hearing loss need to read every single word of the subtitles, never miss a single word, and need them to be as clear and easy to read and prominent as possible. The other end of the scale, you have people who, like the example I was using for the unpredictable audio mixes, you don't really read the subtitles, but like to have them turned on just in case they miss an important word or two. Those players might want their subtitles to be subtle and unobtrusive so they don't get in the way of gameplay when they're not reading them. So, in fact, each one of these examples would actually be the preferred option of a particular group of people. Which presents a bit of a problem, right? which one do you go for if you have these competing interests, competing requirements? Well, the thing is, this is a digital medium, so you don't need to choose one of them. You can just let people choose themselves. And this is standard in other industries. If you open up Netflix, you open up YouTube, if you open up the system menus on the consoles, on PlayStation, Xbox, all this kind of customization is possible. It just hasn't really hit games themselves yet. It's starting to. So in the past year or so, I think there's been now about 7 or 8 games that actually allow you to configure the size of the subtitles. So this is from the latest Hitman game. So you can see it's giving you a preview of the subtitle size over on the right. And you can configure it here. And you can see here that number, 46 pixels. So this is what 46 pixel subtitles look like. You can configure it up to that or lower if you prefer. Another example, this is from Life is Strange. So as well as being able to configure the size of the subtitles all the way up to hella large, you also have this option at the bottom for subtitle semi-opaque overlay, which is a bit of a mouthful. That's their own terminology. What that actually is referring to is letterboxing. So the that black or semi-opaque rectangle that sits behind there to help with the contrast. And it's really simple. They just allow you to turn it on and off. Really, really trivial feature to implement, but really, really valued. And if you look at the reception to Tomb Raider had full solid black letterboxing. You had deaf gamers saying, oh my God, this is the best thing ever. Other gamers saying, oh my God, they want us this. It was like conspiracy theories, thinking that they put it in specifically to discourage people from using subtitles. So they hated it that much. But just that setting, as far as I'm aware, this is so far the only game in the industry that's provided this option. So if you want to be at the cutting edge, the pinnacle of innovation in the games industry, let people turn that black box on and off. It's that simple. And you'll make a lot of people happy as well. So if you just think about those two things, about size, about contrast, those are the big ones. There's a whole load of other stuff you can do if you really want to knock it out of the park with subtitles. I'm not going to run through all this kind of stuff now, but this URL at the top, this is a guide to all this kind of stuff. And this is all coming from lessons learned from other industries. And this doesn't need to be an R&D job. We can just look at those standards and guidelines from other industries, hijack them, and improve our games with them. So the last of these top four, I should explain at the start that the way these top four is decided is from two sources. One is from keeping an eye on social media trends, what people are talking about. The other one is actually hard data from complaints that are actually sent in through submission forms for publishers. So the last one is relating to this quote. When my injury happens, I got extremely depressed. Because I had no finger movement, I figured there was nothing I could really do anymore. So this was a guy I know called Manny. He was in a car accident and ended up C4, C5, quadriplegic. And he was in a very dark place. And what brought him back was gaming. Actually feeling like there's something that he could do to participate on an equal basis in society again. And there were two things that made that happen. One of them was someone built him a custom controller. The other was remapping, allowed him to use that controller with a wide range of games. So I've got someone else actually to help explain why remapping is important. So this chap, he had a stroke as a teenager, and he lost all movement in the right-hand side of his body. But he had zero interest in giving up gaming. And if we just zoom in a bit more, basically what he does is he takes just a regular controller, not a custom controller, and puts it underneath his right arm. He then moves the right stick by moving the entire controller around. That then pushes the stick against his arm, so that gives him the right stick. He uses his left thumb to operate the left thumbstick. That then leaves him four fingers to kind of bend around and reach the other buttons. So he can play pretty well, but obviously he's got kind of limited reach and limited number of buttons that he can operate simultaneously. What he really needs to be able to do is to take those most important, most frequently used functions and move them to an area of the controller that's most comfortable for him, and that's through remapping. So straightforward enough, just letting people reconfigure which button does what. This is an example from Nier Automata. So this functionality, this touches on what Josh was talking about earlier. This functionality is actually offered at system level on both the Xbox and the PlayStation now. But I'm going to quote somebody in the room on this. So a quote from Bice: it's still very important that we continue to ask game developers to insert remapping in their games. So like Josh was saying, that allows you to do things like have access to the remapping so you can update your tutorials and in-game prompts. It allows you to have separate remapping profiles, like the example earlier of Overwatch. So that allows each character to be remapped individually. It allows you to have separate remapping profiles for driving versus walking. It's also really, really important for usability, especially because most of the people who benefit from and use remapping aren't actually people with disabilities. They're just gamers of different preferences. People who aren't necessarily going to think to look in system accessibility menus to be able to reconfigure their controls. They're going to look in the control setting of that individual game. So the remapping at system level is a fantastic safety net. It means there is always a way in for the people that really need it, but it's always, always worth doing it in game if you can. So those top four things, hopefully that's given you a little bit of a flavor of the kind of degree of challenge that's involved in accessibility. These aren't difficult problems to solve. They're all relatively straightforward ways to have a really, really big impact as well. This is a free resource, gameaccessibilityguidelines.com. It has got many more examples like that. And that leads me in to the last little section, the how. So there's two things I want to talk about here. One is about the tools that you have available to you. One of those tools is guidelines, like I just mentioned. Guidelines are great because guidelines are free. The only cost involved in guidelines is the time taken to read them. And they're not dependent on any particular stage of development. You can be reading up on guidelines in advance of even thinking up a game idea. But they do have downsides as well. They're not specific to the challenges in your game. They're also open to interpretation as well. So an example of being open to interpretation, a game that I was tasked with coming in and trying to rescue, who'd been working to an old set of guidelines we used to have at the BBC, which stated that a game must have keyboard controls for people who can only operate things like the Switch technology to start. And the developers interpreted that as meaning that they could make a virtual mouse cursor that you moved around with the cursor keys with all the acceleration and stuff, which actually made it even more difficult to use. So they can be misinterpreted. But there are other tools at your disposal as well, two other tools. One of them is getting expert advice. So there's people internally at Microsoft, people externally, who can get help with this kind of stuff. Help interpret the guidelines specifically to your game. Help solve some of those difficult problems. And the third tool is what we have a picture of. So this screenshot is a screenshot of Half-Life. In particular, what this is a screenshot of is a screenshot of the subtitles in Half-Life. So it had none. And Half-Life is an old game. So Half-Life came out before social media did. So if this was to happen today, it would be a barrage of bile across Twitter. Twitter wasn't around then. So instead, they received letters. Remember those? So they had letters from deaf gamers saying that we love your game. We've heard that there's a really good storyline, but you know, I've got no idea what that storyline is. Is there any way you might have like a script or something you might be able to send us so we can figure out the storyline? And Valve said, well, that's not really going to fly. We're not going to settle for sending scripts to people. We need to get better at this kind of stuff. So fast forward a little bit to Portal. This is the subtitles in Portal, which is quite a different beast. So you can see it has a little bit of that letterboxing. I mean, these could be better, but they're pretty good. You have a little bit of that letterboxing. You have the current speaker at the start of the subtitle. You also have down here where it says smooth jazz. That's actually closed captioning. So the difference between subtitling and closed captioning. Subtitling is text equivalent for speech. So that can be either for accessibility or for localization. Captioning is specifically for hearing impairment. It's when you take that extra step to describe important audio as well as the speech. So this is pretty good. For a long time, this was the pinnacle of subtitling in the games industry. And how they got from this to this was really, really simple. Anytime they did play testing, they ensured they had someone who had hearing loss in the play testing. That's it. So that's the third tool you have at your disposal, which is testing with people with disabilities, getting input from people with disabilities, involving them in the design process. So that can be like this, through playtesting. It can be through through formative user research, like the stuff that Tom and Lauren are doing. It can also just be through having a clear route for feedback, letting people with disabilities know that actually it's okay to contact you about this kind of stuff and providing a clear route for doing that. And these three things, each of these tools has its own pros, its own cons, but if you can combine them together, they cancel out each other's disadvantages. So if you can do one of these things, if you can get some advice, if you need some guidelines, if you can do some testing, then you will make a big difference. If you can combine more than one of them, or if you can combine all three, you will stand the best possible chance of as many people as possible having an enjoyable time with your game. So we're on to the last bit now. So once you've done all this kind of stuff, you know, you've been sold on the idea of accessibility, you've worked on some features, there is one last very, very important consideration to make. And if you don't make this consideration, it can hamstring all of your efforts. And I've got two games here to help me illustrate this. So I assume there will be a fair few people in the room who are familiar with these games. This is Dots on the left and Flow Free on the right. They look kind of similar. They came out around the same kind of time. They play quite differently, but they're basically about connecting together dots of the same color. I'm sure from, if you weren't sure already, that you should at least be sure from the simulations that I've shown you earlier what the problem here is going to be. So if you keep an eye on the right-hand side over here, on the orange, the green, and the red. That's it. It's gone. That's not going to be much fun to try and play. And these games came out after Half-Life. So they didn't receive polite letters. They received tweet storms. Really considerable tweet storms. This went on for about a year after the games launched. Continual barrage of people really not happy about not being able to play these games. So, for example, playing Dots, this game really discriminates against us colorblind people. I won't stand for this. Fight for what's right, hashtag. So what these games can really do with is some kind of consideration for colorblindness, right? For example, some kind of colorblind mode, which they both actually had. So Dots did it through configurable color palettes. Flow Free did it by adding letters onto the colors. So they actually both had effective colorblind modes. The problem was that none of these people knew those modes existed. So you can't work on this kind of stuff and just assume that people are going to know about it and find it. And that's the worst situation to be in. If you've actually gone to this effort of putting design time in, I need to have it not used by people who don't know it's there. So you really, really need to, especially in early days like this, really put in the extra effort to educate people about the work that you've done. There's a few different ways you can do it, go about this. Uncharted. So I had the example up earlier, the accessibility menu in Uncharted. They went to quite some lengths to publicize the work that they'd done. So this nice video up, which Josh was in, talking about not just the features that they did, but the workflow behind it, why it matters to the company, all that kind of stuff. Really, really nice. And that effort to publicize it has sent some ripples throughout the industry as well. You know, other people actually sitting up and taking notice as a result. Oh, come on. Right, that's better. But it doesn't have to be, you know, some huge AAA budget to justify some video content. This is at the other end of the industry. This is a small indie game, and this is a selection of screenshots from the trailer. So they actually dedicated a chunk of the trailer for their game to explaining the accessibility features that they have. Auto fire, colorblind mode, adjustable game speed. Showcased it in the trailer. A really, really useful thing to do is talk about it in game. This is from Battlefield Hardline. And this is the loading screen from Battlefield Hardline, where they have various gameplay tips. And included in that is information about the game's colorblind settings. It's a really, really nice way of communicating. Another method, this is, I think this could well be a first, but don't quote me on that. This is Final Fantasy 15. They actually had a section in their printed manual dedicated to talking about their accessibility features. Or it can be really simple. So this example is from Hue, which was that color-based platformer that I showed you earlier with the symbols. And they put in a single bullet point into their press kit, into their feature listing on their website. And that got picked up. It got picked up by the press. This is a screen grab of their Metacritic. Every single one of their positive reviews on Metacritic was a review that mentioned their colorblind mode. You can see here, this is the top review on there, and the actual quote is about their colorblind mode. And they actually made it into the green on Metacritic by like 1 point. So they are 100% confident that if they hadn't put in that bullet point about their colorblind mode, they wouldn't have done it. That one single bullet point got them up into the green, which has an obvious commercial impact on your game. So on that, I'm going to go back to that statement at the start again, that accessibility is difficult and expensive and means diluting my vision, making the game less enjoyable for everyone just to benefit a tiny niche group. Now, hopefully, from what you've seen, you can see that this is demonstrably false. The reality is more this. Accessibility changes lives and is good for business through sales, through PR, and through gaining loyal advocates. Simple considerations can benefit all players, not just those with impairments, if you consider it from the start of development and let players know that you have. Thank you.